Welcome back to another episode of the Digital Village Podcast, the podcast all about the latest trends in tech and business and the economy. Today, following our recent series on mission innovation, we're leaping into the topic of sustainability versus a circular economy, and we, Australia, how we can start building that capability. Joining our hosts, Luke and Jason, is a returning honoured guest, Nick Gonios, the luminary in sustainable innovation and technology. As the founder of Circulist, our guest is fervently building a world where products don't just serve a singular purpose, but are created for continuous reuse, challenging our conventional manufacturing norms. With an impressive 30-year journey in the tech world, he's woven a legacy that transcends from launching software ventures to playing pivotal roles in the transformation of customer-focused software technologies into global SaaS giants. It's not just about software for him, though. It's about ushering in a future that cares for our planet. Currently, he's also sharing his expertise as a strategic advisor to an array of venturers from the Marine Focus Hullbot in Sydney to the electric-centric EV Safe Charge Inc. in Los Angeles, highlighting their versatile approach to sustainability and innovation. Marrying entrepreneurship with a passion for circular design and sustainability, let's delve into a conversation with this dynamic leader who is redefining the boundaries of product longevity and eco-consciousness.
Hello, here we are with Nicky G, Mr. G, now Mr. Circulist.
Very well said.
Nice to have you here, mate. Nick Gonios, we are sitting with here today. It's been a while since we saw you last year on our podcast, which was great. What was the topic again, Luke?
We were chatting a bit about reimagining education and almost reimagining everything else with Nick, who was like introducing us to the whole movement and the notion of the circularist economy and movement. Yeah.
True. And we haven't seen you for a while. You've been off spending time in Europe and looking forward to hearing a little bit about that. And then we bumped into you again last week, as it happens, at a Tech Central event, which is a great organization, by the way, which was about mission-driven innovation and reaching net zero by 2050. Mm-hmm. And so tell us what's been happening over the last 12 months with the Circulist.
Look, it's been quite interesting. It's one of the first things that I've done, never really lent in and gone really hard, really quick with anything. It's the first time I've actually spent quite a few years just taking a position and really cementing a thought sort of process and articulating what a short, medium, long-term roadmap would look like. Based on 30 years being in tech and being entrepreneurial and working for large multinational software companies around the world, it's probably brought some, I would say there's wisdom, but there's also baggage in terms of mitigation of risk and probably learnings of what to do and what not to do. Nearly gone bankrupt twice and, you know, being really hard on super entrepreneur in Australia has been quite interesting. So for us, we were thinking quite heavily around how do we have a clear point of difference in what we're trying to do. Everybody sort of understood at high level we need to deal with circularity and sustainability. How do we go and tackle it from a dematerialization point of view? The message that we were taking to market at the time was heavily around, you know, advocacy and awareness, and it really struck a chord with it that it was talking the talk, but weren't doing, you know, walking the walk. And we're now getting closer and closer, and I'm really proud of where we're at.
Yeah, it's and I mean, it's a naturally going to be a pretty tough journey given the pretty audacious goal that you've set with the Circulist. And yeah, we'll obviously get you to share more about that shortly. In our last episode on the Digital Village show, we were talking about responsible innovation. And so I'm excited to unpack, you know, these kinds of aspects around innovation and product development in a responsible fashion. And so I'm interested to maybe, you know, kick things off, what your view is in terms of Australia's approach to innovation and if it is sufficient in achieving net zero by 2050.
Okay, let's start off with the former and then we'll talk about the latter in terms of the question. I think the word responsible is so open-ended. It means a lot of things to different people. From my point of view, it's actually just truly being responsible end-to-end around everything that might happen. And, you know, if we go and look at the last sort of 10 to 15 years, what's happened in sort of our technology landscape, social media has democratized everything. in terms of platforms and, you know, all these new infrastructures that are available from our now big tech companies that are out there. And the way they've gone about doing things has really created another let's say, irresponsible actions that are coming from that because of the democratization that's happened, because of sort of the social media platforms that exist, right? And we're seeing the challenges that come with that. We talk about physical type of product, services, and experience. You know, it goes one level deeper in the sense that we are literally polluting the planet. We are becoming so wasteful and overconsumptive in our behaviors, and how the power of tech and instant one click commerce capabilities has enabled us to be poor, responsible citizens and companies and governments, right? So, you know, the term responsible innovation is a great way of looking at things. Then we sort of lean in deep into what it means for in an Australian context. Look, we are dependent on others. We are, as I say, and you guys have heard me speak about the fact that I do believe we are in the arse end of the world when it comes to physical presence and completely part of the global south. A lot of the action and decisions that do get made are actually in the global north. That's just the reality. And we need to try and recognize and own the fact that here we are a young country, and we have to start taking a forward-looking front step foot, be forward and proactive on taking control of this nation, and also becoming responsible about it. We've got so many beautiful, we've got our Indigenous community that actually has 60 plus years of responsibility in terms of the land, the waters, and the way they live, breathe, and operate, right? We need to bring that back again in some way, shape, or form. We all know that. But when it comes to innovation specifically, moving away from the word responsible to innovation, we've been very, very bad in sort of deteriorating our capabilities. I would say, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there is a whole ecosystem, what they call science, research and innovation as an ecosystem. And it's very prevalent in many markets around the world. It's prevalent in Europe. It's probably in the US. Probably US is a lot more sort of driven in terms of driving commercialization. But here it's very prevalent where you attend events here, you attend activities and forums and discussions, and it's the same bubble of people that are always there, being your scientists and your researchers and your innovators and your organizations that are help you get your grant money, all within that sort of ecosystem of SRI, as it's called, right? And unfortunately, that's not well connected with industry and capital in your market, right? And that's the big challenge we have in Australia. And the challenge we have in Australia with that is the fact that we're a big oligopoly. You know, every industry's got about 5 or 6 or 7 major players, which own about 80% of the marketplace. And there is your rats and mice, with all due respect to all the small organizations, that actually are trying to give it a go, right? That's the reality. So that's the reality, guys. It's sort of, that's where we're at. And so tying responsible innovation in the Australian context is fundamentally important. But from my point of view, it's the term responsible innovation in Australia is for us to take bring back control of our sovereign requirements from both a physical presence in what's happening in the world right now geopolitically, and secondly, maintaining our standard of living that could completely disappear if we don't maintain our productivity levels.
I was going to ask. Sorry, Luke. I know haven't spoken up yet. I should have been.
No, that's all right, mate. I thought you were about to. He's going to have like. Something ready to go there for that.
Step in, Luke. Follow on question of you know, what is that disconnect between those research organisations and startups and industry in Australia?
So, again, going back to what I said before, it's an oligopoly of an economy.
Yeah,
we don't have a middle economy, right? Yeah.
And does that mean that you're saying that
we have enough competition?
That? Yeah,
there's no incentive.
Making sure that they're keeping, keeping that power. And not letting competitive new players.
That's one other thing. The other big thing is one of our worst success metrics at the moment is the fact that we've broken the world record on number of years of uninterrupted growth and no recession. Mm-hmm. When I finished university 31 years ago, that was the last time we had a recession, guys. I finished with a Bachelor of Science with a major in information, proudly from UNSW.
Yeah.
Right? Not knowing what the hell I was doing. Right. And guess what happened? It took me about 10 months to get a gig.
Yeah.
I started the degree when we'd buy the Tuesday's Australian, what's the paper to buy for all tech jobs?
Yep.
Used to be massive.
Remember that,
Luke?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. And then when I finished, it was the thinnest thing ever because we had our recession.
Right.
And it took me like 9, 10, 12 months to find a gig. Right. And it was the last time we've had a recession since. And we've been sort of masquerading and sort of covering and, you know, blocking and weaving so we don't have a recession. For me, the best thing can happen to Australia for us to have a massive recession right now, to create a forcing mechanism of change that will really rock the boat, right? It's nothing not popular thing to say, but it needs to happen because it's happened in other parts of the world and it's not happening here.
And so you think that would produce the incentives that need to be there for all of that, I guess, you know, innovation and research to basically, you know, bridge the gap and jump into a commercial setting and something like, oh, this is now a differentiator. Now there's a big advantage like waiting for us if we can utilize those things.
Well, urgency, right?
Yeah.
Urgency, massive unemployment.
Mm.
That's when it's happened. When there's massive unemployment and real estate has blown up, right? When real estate blows up and there's massive unemployment and there's people on the streets, that's when things change.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been masquerading around that for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it needs to happen. You know, I don't want it to happen, but it needs to happen.
Yeah.
You know, any markets internationally where it's happened, things have flourished, and new ecosystems and formations, things have happened, right? So, you know, I don't want to talk about wars, but it's another example of when things actually drive things, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
So, but that's what we need to do. And I think to be proactive about it is to recognize that, you know, that's a worst case scenario. How do we create a framework that actually helps us smoothly go through that? And
So let's say there's a massive change in the market, in the world, in the economy, and so
there's also let's imagine there's all of this, I guess, change in the environment of economic environment, markets, and so on. There's maybe really high unemployment.
Yep.
And so this is a motivator, or what is that about that creates that change, and what might we see happen?
It creates an urgency to fucking act.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry about the French.
Act in what way?
Act to basically get our shit together and stop procrastinating. Mm. Right. We basically, unfortunately, we go about markets and we go things about programmatically.
Yep.
Like there's a lot of things that we do. I mean, to be fair, the last 10 years have been bloody hard with, you know, with how we've been seeing things from a sustainability and circularity point of view. This local market, we'll go there later.
Yep. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we've been happy-go-lucky, right? Mm. We need an excuse to actually force a change.
Yep.
And you know, proactively, in my view, we need to, you know, government. We depend too much on government in Australia.
Mm.
Yeah. We depend too much on government in Australia, as though everything's going to come from from government's policy making, right? The reality is, government needs to be a market shaper and a one stakeholder of a few, and not just be the regulatory and compliance officer, right? It's really important. In other markets, it's happening. There is an amazing economist in the UK, which I amazingly would love to find a way to partner with, called Mariana Mazzucato, who has written an amazing set of books. And one of them that is really, really connected with resonates is called The Mission Economy.
Yeah.
And she talks about government being a market shaper, right, as part of one of the important stakeholders in the economy, and actually having a deep interest and passion around what bureaucracy can do for civic services across the board, right, and our economy and society, right? And, you know, if you start going down the path of how the consulting industry has taken over and creating a toxic environment around how things done for the sake of, you know, more and more reports to be published, it's been the big awakening for me, guys, this year, that we need more reports, right?
Yeah.
Right? We don't need any more reports.
Well, there's been, I mean, it's something that, again, Australia has done very well over the last, however, you know, decade, I suppose, around reporting on ESG and these kinds of things. And there's, you know, we're at this event only yesterday around sustainability, and they were talking about...
Another one?
Yeah. They were talking about, especially corporates and their... I guess, addiction to ticking boxes and leaving it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's the cheapest way to get something done, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, look, you know, look, but we're doing our part, but it's kind of getting to the point now where, you know, that's obviously not adequate.
Mm.
So what is to happen now? So what would be a good message for them, I suppose, who are ticking their boxes? They've got their nice reports and their metrics that are being provided to them by their very pretty consulting firms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they look great as well.
I love Barangaroo. Yep.
Yeah. And so what now?
What now is to basically truly transition and transform, right? So as we know, reports are a snapshot in time.
Mm.
Nothing wrong with ESG reports. Mm. It's just you need to back it up with actual real action, right? Mm. And so... the reality is we need to shift towards. Let's take a backstory and sort of let me tell you a bit of a story around a book that I was reading called Why Elephants Can't Dance, mm-hmm. which is over 20 years ago. Sitting on a Greek island, I was reading a business book, typical me. Sitting on a Greek island 20 years ago, getting a tan, and reading this book by Lou Gerstner, who was the CEO that got appointed, that with IBM was basically going to blow up in 18 months' time. Back in the day, they were literally running.
Yeah, through, right. Okay.
Yeah, they were such a multi-matrixed environment with so many divisions, right? That it took Lou Gerstner, who came in 18 months, to basically work out what the hell's going on here, right? Why are we going down the way we're going? And what he got to realize, right? Such a simple human behavior, which relates to what we're talking about here today, basically going back to corporates and large organizations and other large entities, is people respect what's inspected of them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? In simple terms, if I'm earning $500,000 a year, or $100,000 a year, let's say, or $50,000 a year, right? And in my job function and my KPIs and my objectives are to do three things bloody well, to get my bonus or to maintain my job or get promoted, guess what I'm going to do? It's human nature.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? I'm going to focus on doing those three things. Whether the right things or not, I'm going to do them. Right? And guess what was happening in IBM? They were focusing on the wrong things that they were being inspected on.
Incentivizing the wrong things.
All the wrong things. Yeah. So the point is, he quickly realized that and they restructured the incentive systems to basically align against the common mission that IBM had. Mm. Right? And that's when they got their shit together and came out the other end. And so the fundamental requirements around, my biggest lesson in business is one of those, is you basically need to incentivize and put the right platforms in place to drive people on along a journey, right? Mm. Cross-disciplinary, teams action-oriented, outcomes-based KPIs and incentivized structures, right? Let's not talk about the sticks, right? That's another thing, because you want to eliminate out, bad actors. Sure. And you also need to have servant leadership in the equation. It's one thing that we do poorly in Australia. We don't have servant leadership in the market around common missions and outcomes. We're really good at driving programs. Mm. We can roll out programs and we can self-serve. It's why incubators and accelerators don't work, right? I can talk a lot about that, right? They're broken, right? Because they self-serve themselves.
Yeah. Can we spend 30 seconds on that? that's a really side note.
Yeah.
I feel it's too interesting to let go.
Yeah. I'm just sort of stirring the pot here.
Let's just spend a minute just quickly on that.
Okay.
Yeah. A minute.
Let's have it.
A minute.
Maybe two. Okay. So like why don't incubators and accelerators work?
Well, in Australia, right? One of the big challenges you have is that we haven't got enough startups, right?
Okay.
We haven't got enough startups, basically. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you have programs that sort of come about a particular theme like circular economy or, climate tech or, SaaS or, whatever, health.
Yeah.
I just make this stuff up
sure,
now.
Yeah. Sure.
Or they're all in Victoria, or they're all in Queensland. And most of these accelerators and incubators unfortunately have to have achieved a certain number of startups to go through the program.
Right.
Mm. And therefore...
That's their KPI, right?
It's the KPI.
Yeah.
It's the number of people and organization they can put through the system because that's how they're paid and to execute with, right? Because they've been KPI'd and the money's coming from grant money or whatever else it might be, right?
Yeah.
How many are going to publish through? So therefore, they basically grab as many as they can and they put them through the system and they basically run their pitch fests and they finish up and they get on with the next ones because that's why they exist. Mm. Now, versus being outcomes oriented, where are they going? How they take them to the next level? Every startup is different in its own right. Different founders, different makeup, different problems they're trying to solve. It's actually even harder in circularity and sustainability and climate tech because we're talking about non-digital stuff. It's hardware. Yeah. There's great examples of many out there. Like I'm actually a proud member of the Boomerang Labs Circular Economy Accelerator, right? I've been a mentor and advisor at H2 Ventures. I was an original, very, very small investor in Pollinizer in the early days, right? And many others. I've done, so many at, we've ran many different programs with Singtel and Macquarie Bank and Coca-Cola. How do we take entrepreneurs to become entrepreneurs? And, it's been a really interesting experience. And for us, it was, I have a very interesting story that Phil Mall shared with me, who's now at Main Sequence, when they were running Pollinizer with Mick Lubinskis, where they were going through this challenge of, had like 10, 20, 30 staff, I can't remember what it was, and they were pumping through all these different sort of e-commerce digital plays back in the day. And there was a time when One of them was just kicking out of the park. It was, I think it was December, and they had to pump through heaps of product through the machine. That all the employees had to stay back 7 days a week for 3 weeks to actually get this stuff out the door because it was working.
Yeah. Yeah.
Market fit was happening, right?
Yep.
And there was a moment in time when Phil went and said, hey, everyone needs to work 7 days a week through the next 3 weeks to get basically help this startup sort of flourish.
Yeah.
And what came to the realization was most people there were employees, 9 to 5. They weren't aligned with the startup founders.
Yeah, okay.
And so with that came a realization that, you know, what type of structure and incentive systems do we have, even at Polonize at the time? And I'll just park that aside, but we can go.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was people respect what's inspected. I mean, it's the same in startups and accelerators. Accelerators and incubators.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And so I guess we've talked about, miles away, yeah. But I'm not ready to let it go yet.
Oh my God.
We've talked about what the
4-hour podcast.
I know, he's dying. We're talking about what the wrong KPIs are.
Yeah.
What are the right ones for an accelerator?
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, we do know Y Combinator and all these other great ones are working really well. There's Entrepreneur First in Europe, which is kicking it out of the park.
Yeah.
It's actually really celebrating and bringing the best you can for the founders to unblock things, in my view, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the challenge with that is that, the other part you need to have capital in place to be able to support them to the next level, right? And that's the other big issue we have in Australia, mm-hmm. right? There's just not enough capital to support them through the next stage, right? They sort of either wither away. You know, a lot of the Boomerang Labs ones at the moment have got great potential, but we can't find the money to actually back them to let them become set free, which is quite sad, right?
Yeah.
So the other last thing is that I would just think that, if we had more experienced mentors that came to the table to deliver real value, it'd be great. I mean, we don't need more people that have sort of come out of corporate land or government wanting to do startups with no real, rolled up your sleeves, nearly gone bankrupt experience.
Yeah.
That's the other reality. We've got too many people that sort of are just filling in time for the sake of want to be known as I will say this, you know, there's too many people out there just, you know, want status and identity around being a startup mentor without any real experience and, you know, they haven't been knocked about by it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's an experience that you can't fake.
It's
leaves a mark, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I mean, it left a big mark on me, let me tell you, right?
Yeah.
I've had my cries, you know.
And that's, they're the best lessons, you know, aren't they?
Mm. Yeah, 100%. And my boys and my family have seen that.
Yeah.
It's lived it, you know. Mm. They've seen the good and the bad, you know. It's just the reality. So, and I'm proud of it now. I used to have a hard time dealing with it, but I now lean in and serve. I serve the community as much as I can.
Yeah.
Right.
Help others through the valley of death.
Exactly. Yeah.
The valley of death. Yeah. Well, they say that.
We're
going to
die, right?
Of like,
we're going to die. This is the other thing, you know. We're memento mori, mate. Memento mori. We're going to die. People, my mate of mine in Melbourne says to me, Sam Salter's an amazing chap, amazing mate of mine. He said, "Oh, you know, Nick, we've got 30 summers in us, and we've got to live them every summer."
I like that.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. So, what do you reckon? Back on track?
Okay.
So, but look, I think it's
where were we?
Yeah, innovation.
Yeah,
innovation.
Accelerators, startups. And so I think it's interesting that we've been talking about that, and we're talking about the challenges with, you know, industry and how we incentivize things here. I think it'd be good to maybe talk a little bit about what you've wanted to achieve with, you know, the Circulist here and, and why you're heading overseas.
Heading over to Europe.
Mm. Yeah.
Heading over to Europe. For the last few years, I'm going to talk about a real personal thing that happened to me.
Sure.
Which sort of was the trigger for everything, yeah?
Yeah.
I'm a very visual person. I see things and try and make them happen. It's sort of the spirit that I have. And it's, in some ways, it's my crazy superpower, whatever you want to call it. As a kid, I wanted to be an industrial designer or an architect.
Okay. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've said that before. And I just have a deep passion for design and the built world. Just deep passion for it. I just, you know. But in that point, that time was very much around just producing and designing aesthetically beautiful products and brand experiences in terms of the physical form.
Mm.
And I fell into computing by accident at the time. I played too much tennis when I was a kid. Used to be an A1 tennis player.
Oh, mate.
You can't tell with the physique I have now. Used to wear those sort of Ivan Lendl shorts and tops back in the day. Really cool and funky back
in
the day.
What a vision, mate.
I visualized that, hey? Yeah. and had hair. I fell into computing by accident, and I've been in that industry for a long time. And the most out of many minutes that I had in my life. This is the only minute that I remember so clearly in my whole life. Was close to 7 years ago when I saw my father take his last breath, and that brings tears to my eyes every time I talk about it. But September the 29th, 2016. 10:22 p.m. I saw my father take his last few breaths in life, and then the last big gasp. Yeah, and I saw his body change within an hour, and his face, and it really knocked me about. I'm open to talking about these types of things, and it really I really went into a low for a period of time. A few days later, I had to apart from having to deal with Dad's family, funeral stuff literally the next day and all that stuff. A few days later after that happened, we took our dog for a walk. I took him for a walk, little Aspro, and just walking around, grabbing a coffee, seeing people just living life, right? Yeah. And as they say, I'm big with sayings, life goes on, right? And I experienced that firsthand.
Yeah.
And a few days later, guys, I actually resigned as a public-facing CEO of a software group that I was running called Acommon back then, which I was having a great time, doing great things, building a great team. I decided I had to drive it. I did bring back. I had a sense of reason and need to actually change. 25 years in tech at the time, doing things, having a great time, being global. I really felt like there was a reason that I had to basically recognize, seeing that I just see Dad sort of pass away. Life's short. It hit me. And with that came ever so slowly an interest in circularity. Thanks to Google.
Oh, yeah.
Just doing a search on something. I can't remember what it was, to be honest. I did a search. Yeah. And circular economy fell into my search. I don't know what it was. It must have presented something to me. And I went. I'm really good at going down into rabbit holes, right? I'm a constantly curious type of person. And went down into a rabbit hole and just unblocked everything that I was dealing with at the time. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is quite amazing stuff. It really started to rattle the cage around the world that we're living in and operating with. And from that came about a deep interest with regards to knowing what I knew about and how people operate and the sense of belonging and so forth. There are too many people out there that basically talk about circularity and circular economy and sustainability as professions and sort of frameworks, but there wasn't a term, I felt, that actually enabled somebody to say, hand on heart, this is who I am. Mm. Yeah. And so, two or three years later, probably about three years ago, I... had best thinking time is in the shower for me, and really sat back and just was thinking about these words that are out there, which was like industrialists and waste and recycling, and it was all stuff that really felt negative and toxic and to me, and for some people it's just the norm, but for me, yeah, it just didn't feel right. And what I came to was a position. I had this amazing light bulb experience, which was circularist. Is it right? And that term hit me, and I said, "This is the term that will basically help millions of people that believe in what we're doing to come along on the journey with us." Yeah, and that was the beginning of Circulus.
Yeah,
and it was a thought bubble at the time.
Yeah,
but now we have a lot of clarity in what we're doing.
Okay, great. So, what does that embody for you? That term, Circulus.
So, what is a Circulus? A Circulus starting first and foremost is the opposite to being an industrialist.
Okay.
The first thing.
Yeah.
So when people talk about, and I read blog posts and articles about, let's reindustrialize the economy. I'm hearing local government, I'm hearing government talking about this. Let's just reindustrialize everything. And I'm like, no, let me put a sword through that and cut that word out completely. Right? Let's all become circularist. Right? So very important to use new language to basically look forward through the front windscreen of a car than actually look through the rearview mirror. Right? And it's in that context that we need to start creating new sense of language. And so where are we at? The other interesting zeitgeist moment is that we have a deep alignment right now in this natural sort of momentum that's building around electrifying the world and decarbonizing the world, right? And those two things collectively are what sort of is driving this whole air around sustainability as a term, right?
Sure.
And so electrifying the world and decarbonizing the world, we must do, right? How we go about doing it is another thing. What type of, how we get away from fossil fuels and do we use sun, wind, water and all that other stuff. And nuclear, who knows, right? Whatever it might be. how we go about that is one thing. But the third important element that is a very, very clear point of difference for Circulist, which is sort of the thing that triangulates everything for me, which doesn't exist, and it does exist, but we don't talk enough about it, is we must also dematerialize everything, right? So we don't just electrify everything. We don't just decarbonize everything. We must also dematerialize everything. And what does that mean?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a term from maybe Star Trek, appearing in one place and disappearing in another. So
totally.
Dematerialization, what is that?
Yeah. I mean, maybe that, that's, I should probably find some, you know, Dr. Spock professors around the world to try and work that out, right? But what does it mean? It simply means we need to, one of the three core principles of circularity, of circular economy, is to basically try and minimize the amount of virgin raw materials that we take from our Mother Earth and maximize the amount of materials that we have on our Earth in our products and basically regenerate and reuse them to an infinite amount of time, right? And start to value those materials at the core, right?
Sure.
At the moment, we don't value them at all. We produce them. We take them out of our motherland, our earth, our precious earth. We basically produce stuff once. We use them several times, and then we just they just disappear in this invisible land of collection. I don't even call it recycling.
Yeah,
it's just collection.
Yep.
and so we need to solve for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so dematerialization.
Yes.
Means for you to really, I guess. It's not so much like we're not going to use materials anymore, but we're going to keep using the same ones and track them and
account for them.
This is the key thing, right? So we are going to use them. We just don't want to use more out of our earth. Right?
Yeah.
It's really that big change, right? There's a mass opportunity for urban mining to happen, right, as well, if you've heard that term before.
Yeah.
Where this our landfills are full of all this stuff,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's lots of stuff lying around, isn't there?
A lot of stuff lying around. So... The other. So with that, our whole focus is around how do we dematerialize. Our vision is to how do we dematerialize the world, and reimagine products for good, right? And the type of products that we're talking about are those hard, well-designed products that are in market. Our appliances, our devices at home, our appliances and devices and instruments at scientific labs, in our hospitals, in our schools, across our major cities. All this where we live, work, learn, and play. We have all these thousands and tens of thousands of products and appliances and devices that are the most difficult to recycle and rebuild because they've been so well designed in inverted commas.
Yeah.
Right? And we need to seriously become, to go back to your beautiful word, responsible when it comes to that whole process, right? And that's what we want to try and tackle.
So let's dig into that a little bit in terms of product development.
Yes.
Electrifying the world,
yes,
and this interconnected world that we're, you know, moving towards, and hyper-connected world, hyper-electrified world, pretty much everything is going to be, you know, our experience of interaction in the world's going to be very electronic, and so there's going to be a huge need for the manufacturing and production of these products, and so what would an industrialist do? And then what would a circulist do?
Wow, love it. Two scenarios. I want all the industrialists to go to with Elon Musk to Mars.
Yeah.
They can sort of find their one-way trip to there and try and work out what they do there with fossil fuels that they'll find over there. So what will industrialists do? Here's what happens, right? In an ever-changing world, they're going to be winners and we're going to be winners. Sort of followers, and they're going to be new winners. Sorry, they're going to be big losers.
Yeah,
they're going to be some new sort of players, and they're going to be the ones that are going to stagnate. Right, that's just the norm. Mm. So, in the industrial complex that we operate under right now, where we have massive mega factories and global supply chains, and everything's driven by price and real time or near time, you know, all that.
Mm.
It's supporting a current behavior that's been manifested for the last 50 to 70 years, thanks to Mad Men and so forth, right?
Mm.
Having us fall in love with brands, you know, being driven by attention economy and, you know, playing with our minds and having us connected with brands for the sake of brands and, you know, so forth, and not actually valuing what's within these products that we're buying. Mm. Because it's just the way it is, and it's
whole attention economy.
Whole attention economy and the metrics around GDP and productivity and what the hell do they mean, right?
Mm.
Why does the term growth? Why is growth so important? You know, the post that we're going to plan to write recently is going to be around degrowth, right? Mm. And I think the problem with that is that the term degrowth is the problem, right?
Yeah. So, sounds scary.
Sounds scary, right?
Yeah. Doesn't sound very call profitable it anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
So for an industrialist, it's very much, for us, all the industrialists, I'm going to put it out there, really proud of what they're doing, but they're frogs simmering in boiling water, right? They're frogs simmering in boiling water until our circulars come on and take on the charge and really reimagine the new operating model that needs to happen in the world. Yeah. And so for it to be a circulist, we have these five core principles, right? And will you want to unpack those core principles?
Yeah, like a good way to
we'll unpack those five core principles, and we have our five integrated C's, right? Yeah. These two frameworks are really important, and we've really come to a position on it in the last 2 to 3 months, which we're really proud of. And it really is at the cornerstone of us driving this approach that we're taking. So the five principles are basically this. For a circulist to be a circulist, both firstly, let's say as an organization and then as individuals and teams, you must believe in the fact that your company or your company needs to shift away from being a product-centric company to being a material-centric company. Yeah. Mm. So if you think about the way people respect what's inspected of them, like we spoke about before, companies that produce stuff, the mics that we're holding, one of the amazing companies in Australia is Rode, right? But they're still stuck in industrialized land in some ways, right? We don't have an ability to send back these microphones that we have and have them remade again in Sydney again. They've got an amazing world-class, you know, $100 million plus manufacturing plant in Silverwater here. How are they basically closing the loop in terms of taking all the products out of here and rebuilding them through a material-centric view of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they sell millions and millions of products around the world, right? I don't want to pick them. They're amazing. I love Brody, right?
Yeah.
But there are hundreds of there are many organizations out there that are having that continue under that pathway, right? So if we shifted away from products to materials and putting materials at the center of a company's operating model, simply imagine having a CFO. Think about this. Imagine having a CFO of your company that now has on the balance sheet a new asset class called what? Materials.
Materials, yeah.
Right? We've got about $100 million worth of materials on our balance sheet.
Mm.
Oh, that's interesting. We need to value that now, shouldn't we? Right?
Yeah.
Now, how we track, measure, and verify that's another thing which we'll talk about really quickly later on. That's the first one, right? The first one is...
Quick question. Yeah, Luke. How would you see the difference between that and just inventory?
Because people look at
a lot of inventory and my God, we need to move this stuff.
It's a great question because... The KPI on having inventory a la products is we have an input that was used. We didn't get it.
Yeah.
We paid for it.
Yeah,
manufactured in some Asian market, wherever it might have been, maybe Europe, wherever it might be. I don't care where it was manufactured, but it was an input
to
come to the product, which is what we value, that is sitting on our shelf that we're paying warehouse fees for.
Yeah.
That is some margin that we expect to make.
Yeah.
And it's all driven by the wholesale price that we have for that product and the gross margin, right?
Mm.
So in that instant, the CFO only cares about how many products we have sitting on our shelves and how much margin we're going to make and shelf life of that product not moving.
Mm.
And that's all they care about.
Yeah.
So it sits on the other side of the balance sheet. It sits on the P&L, not on the balance sheet, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It's a massive change. Can I just say that what I've seen in software, the software space, which I was part of transforming software companies to becoming SaaS companies, there's this beautiful, and I don't know if you know this, but there's what they call the fish effect. Yep. The fish effect of transformation.
Okay.
And this is what there's some secret sauce here. So.
Yeah.
All right.
And so the secret sauce around it is that you need to basically take organizations through the fish effect. And we'll talk about that another time, I think.
Sure, mate.
We'll leave that aside.
Okay. Probably, I made a note of that.
Good, yeah.
Good on you, mate.
The fish effect. So the fish effect is what actually enabled me to take software companies and make them SaaS companies and you know, drive 5 to 10 times top line, you know, shareholder value because of the way we change things, right? But you have to invest. You have to invest in the transformation.
Yeah.
To shift towards subscription services revenues, basically, which is where the value is. Right. So the second point is actually shifting away from ownership to usership and subscription. Right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the only way to become responsible, guys, at high level, is to actually control the asset class or the product with the materials in it. Okay. If you don't control it and be responsible for it, how and why will you value it?
Yeah, that's right. You know,
I am a home appliances company. I won't even name names. and I produce appliances in Europe because they're amazing, and I have about 50 subsidiaries around the world, and I just produce them and I just sell them into those markets. And once the products get sold through the retailers or possibly direct, what happens? It becomes responsibility of governments and citizens to tackle the e-waste or the waste that comes with it, right?
It's externalizing of that problem, right? Yeah,
so, issues. But shouldn't companies and brands become responsible for things end-to-end in terms of a closed-loop way? They have all the intent in the world, but at a local level, they can't because they're a subsidiary.
They don't have recycling directly involved,
right? Yeah. So, which leads into our third principle, which is this really long, and I've got to go fast here now, right? Basically shifting from global mega factories and supply chains, which is sort of the industrial complex of all, to starting to decentralize and shift towards having physical, beautiful, sustainable and circular points of presence that we call micro-assembly service centers in circular speak. Yeah. And so these micro-assembly service centers is where the heart and soul of what we want to try and do with Circulist is at, right? And it's where we will... Envisage an Apple experience, an Apple store right now. The way I'm going to connect it for you guys and try and visualize it, because it's a little bit theoretical at this stage and sort of storyboardish. But imagine having an Apple. You know, we're in Sydney. We're in, you know, George Street, the corner, George sure. Street Church. Yeah. You know, the church, the cult. The church, I love my Apple gear. Walk in there and you experience it. And then the challenge is you see this person, you buy a new MacBook. I think I walked in and bought a new iPad mini last week because I needed one. Didn't really need one, but yeah, I bought one.
justification.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That was the power of the band pulling me in, right? Yeah. Having said that, they're one of the most circulist companies that are going forward, which we can talk about that. Yeah. But I walked in there and the guy took my money, $1,000, whatever it was, and he went behind the big stainless steel beautiful looking, what do we call it? The curtain? No, the actual...
The facade.
And he went through and he went back into Oompa Loompa Land, as I call it, and came back with the magical iPad mini, right? Yeah. How that happened, we don't know. We're consumers.
No one knows behind the scenes,
right? Sort of Oompa Loompas are running around producing this stuff, right?
In their little blue shirts.
Yeah. It's Jeez. It's Mr. Jeez. Yeah, that's his. Yeah. And so the point here is that I wouldn't say we take it for granted because there's a lot of sort of conscious consumers and businesses out there want to do good, but it's been presented in such a way that we don't really put it in our front and center. So it's part of our invisible sort of subconscious state. Imagine if our micro assembly service centers were that for every brand in the world, but also had production, service, and recycling in the back, where we could actually see it and experience it with these what we call smart collar workers working in partnership with robots and automation, recycling and remaking these products again. Apple actually has Daisy 1 and Daisy 2 in Cupertino, where they're recycling hundreds of iPhones right now every day as an experiment to see how they can really do that and start to disassemble their own products and get better at how they design things, right? So that's the third one. I'll go really fast on the fourth ones, which is basically bringing good, meaningful jobs back into local cities again in a services-based economy, which is Australia as well, which is actually our big downfall, our big sort of issue right now, is how do we start bringing good jobs back into cities that actually have meaning and purpose in people's lives, right, is critical. So we need to bring back good, meaningful jobs again. And the last one is actually rolling it all out with trillions of dollars of green circular infrastructure capital that's required to make this happen, right? So they're our five principles, and our five C's, just to rattle off really quickly, which are associated to our vision and our missions, is the integrated fifth C is the Circulist, right? And so our other four C's are three core missions, which the first one is around how do we build a committed community? The first C is community. Yeah. And how do we build a committed community that actually helps product manufacturing leaders and ambitious product entrepreneurs to basically build and roll out sustainable circular practices for a better world? First time I'll say this, and we're going to announce it soon, but we want 1 million of those globally. Our mission is to guide 1 million product manufacturing leaders and ambitious product entrepreneurs towards a better world through better sustainable and circular practices, right? That's our first mission. We'll talk a bit about, we won't talk about what we're looking at doing there yet, but that's our first. The second is bringing companies and capital to market, not just startups. It's a very big difference. It's very big things that I've realized after being what I've been doing so many years is that startups are not the answer. Startups are one part of the play. mm-hmm. right? Startups taste make. They basically create new tastes and experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they don't have the capacity to actually build for long-term sustainability, mm-hmm. right? No. So in that context, we need to basically bring startups with existing players, create demand, solve big problems, and in partnership with government, to basically build long-lasting, sustainable companies for the future that last hundreds of years, mm. right? The fourth is, simply, we need to basically build the tools and technologies around what we call capabilities. It's our fourth C. And in that is where we basically, it's important for us to try and reimagine materials intelligence, as we call it, reimagine how we actually value and track, measure, and verify real-time usage of materials within our products at the core. With that comes, how do we build trust around that and transparency? Because that's the other big issue for me. It's like I see material fraud. I call it material fraud everywhere in the world right now. We need to unblock that. And on top of that, very much then looking at that, saying the digital experience is one thing. The next thing is, how do we bring to life this brand new form of built world, which is what we call the microassembly service center, right? We want tens of thousands of those around the world to really start to drive the new economic and social frontier that we require back in our local cities.
Mm. Yeah. It's a big vision, Nick.
It is a big one, and we've got clarity in where we're starting now, which is good.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It goes back to what you're saying. Why am I still here?
Yeah.
Which I didn't
answer that.
I didn't answer that part because I got into that deep dive. I've been struggling a lot, guys, in Australia, trying to think about, you know, the challenge that we have and the oligopoly economy that we have, 31 years of uninterrupted growth, great smart people here, capital and sort of research innovation just completely misaligned, you know, not integrated. And then I think about trying to push myself to do stuff in Australia and especially this BHAG of a BHAG. How do we make it happen in Australia, which is so far away from the rest of the world? Mm. You know, we lack intent and urgency. Right?
Yeah.
At a core, we lack intent and urgency.
Yeah.
We have some intent, but we lack urgency.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the sad truth.
Yeah.
The untold truths.
Pretty comfortable.
Pretty comfortable. Happy-go-lucky, you know, and so forth. And to be fair, I really wanted to do a lot of things in Australia. I still do. And I think, unfortunately, it has to go and have to take this to another market to validate it there to bring it back. That's sort of the thinking that I have at the moment. And I'll say this, but I think we have too many consultants and advocates in our world in Australia, publishing more reports and running more events, and it's imbalanced with not enough practitioners and doers around circularity and sustainability. Yeah, that's amazing. People that want to do circular and sustainability, they're just not being backed.
Mm.
Yeah, they're not being backed. I mean, seriously, we've got $4 trillion allocated in our super funds. It just should be mandated. Like 1 or 2% goes to where it should go, right? Mandated. How do you say that? I mean, by that, you can't do that, right?
Excuse me.
I've spent probably 5 or 6 months this year in Europe as part of the transformation I'm going through as a person. And, you know, what I've seen firsthand in Europe is just a real intent to drive change and action towards a greener economy as a continent in general. UK was included in that, but not now.
I mean, there's regulatory pressure there, isn't there?
There is. So let's talk about that. There is real regulatory pressure, and let's unpack that a bit. The reality is that I've got a frog in my throat. The reality is that the banks are actually being forced by the EU to implement what they call transition plans, right? And these transition plans are actually the next stage past ESG reporting, right? And that's actually the old school days of talking about business transformation is what we call transition plans with a green twist at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right? A green sustainable circular twist. Just simple, right? We haven't done change management or transformation really well in Australia because we're stuck. But in other parts in Europe where there's and Europe and the US where there are forces and market changes and competition at a much more deeper level, it's a requirement, right? Mm. So these banks are now being forced to sort of implement these transition plans. With that comes their stakeholders, which are their customers and their potential organisations that want to basically get finance from them. And there's hundreds of billions of dollars, guys, hundreds of billions of euros waiting to be deployed. And therefore, they need to try and bring all these organisations into the mix. And so there are currently in Europe, there's about 4,000 organisations that have gone through this whole process of transition planning. And the EU government wants to actually get about 100,000 over the next 3 to 4 years through that program, through that process, right? And so this beautiful sort of formation of a new standardized model of mitigating or sort of risk assessment, how to actually look at deploying a framework of short, medium, long-term horizons, which is how do we take a product manufacturing company and think about what they're going to do for the next 5, 10, and 25 years? Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
And then also, how much capital are they going to require? They're going to require 50 million to half a billion, right? That in itself is what's attracting us right now as Circulus, is to lean into where the actual need is right now. Everything that we've been talking about, I can openly say that it's been quite reimagining the future type of stuff, sort of third horizon stuff and beyond.
Yeah.
But we are literally going as an organization towards tackling real problems real now, where there's a real need. And we'll be launching some programs around that will be announced soon. And that's exactly the reason why I'm shifting to Europe, to actually bring it to make it happen there as a starting point to then launch what we want to do next year, which is a very, very big circular symposium that will bring practitioners together and drive a really strong community of practice of all the organizations that we work with, not government red ribbon ceremonies and policy announcements and sort of academics sharing more research, right?
Yeah. So with all those organizations in Europe that need to go through that process, do you see all of those practitioners as key to being able to like make that happen?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
100%, they're there, right? They're there. They just don't know how. When last trip I was there, I actually met with quite a few product manufacturing companies in Southern Europe and Northern Europe, right? Mm. And I would talk to them and just talk about what we're doing, and I'd ask them a simple question. So, what are you guys doing about sustainability and circularity?
Yeah.
And they would say to me, common response would be, oh, we're going to bring some ESG consultants in and we'll understand where we're at with an ESG report. And it was quite opening in my view because, you know, from their perspective, you know, producing the report is sort of the tick on the box.
Yeah.
But they also recognize that they just don't know how to get started.
Yeah.
Short, medium and long term, right?
Yeah.
So really going in and helping these practitioners, and we talk about practitioners, we're talking about product manufacturing leaders who actually operate different operating units within an organization, or they own manufacturing or the customer experience, whatever it might be, R&D, all have the intent to want to get there, but they just don't know how. So the analogy that I use coming from sort of corporate land is the old corporate strategy officer role 20 years ago is what the new sustainability and circularity officer function is now. And you want me to unpack that a bit?
Maybe
describe the difference between sustainability and circularity.
Oh, okay, yes, we forgot to do that. Excuse me. So in our view of the world, circular view of the world, sustainability basically means electrifying and decarbonizing the world is at the core of sustainability, which is around climate net zero, right? Climate net zero is sort of the zeitgeist around sustainability, right? Yet, what we're not talking enough about, so if we just scope that as being that and containing it to be that, which is pretty much what it is, what's not part of that is how we're going to think about the third pillar we talk about, which is dematerialization and valuing the materials and how we produce things and how we consume stuff, right? Which in sustainability land, that's called scope 3 emissions. They're the hardest things to deal with, right?
Yeah, okay.
So scope 3 emissions for us becomes the dematerialization pillar, which ultimately is at the core of being circularity focused, right?
Yeah.
So sustainability is very much around electrifying, decarbonizing, the two pillars.
Mm.
And then circularity and circular economy stuff is very much around dematerialization, how we produce and consume stuff and recycle stuff, and remake stuff. It's that simple.
Mm.
When you break it up that way, is that pretty clear?
That's good. So if I was going to say, if I know we're working on like long time horizons to get to where we need to be, but
three generations, I reckon.
The world economy is going to look very different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a massive amount of the economy, the world economy, especially in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Revolves around pulling stuff out of the ground,
mm-hmm.
and if we say, we'd like to do a lot less of that,
mm-hmm.
then that is a huge economic transition, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my bugbears at the moment. Knowing that economy is so dependent on that pillar, right?
Yeah,
of taking stuff out of our earth. I think I read a fact, if we ran a business like the one where we're in our economy, it's really risky, right? And I remember it was actually in the Atlas Economic Complexity Index that Harvard does.
Yeah.
We were ranked so poorly. And in today's market, in today's world, we have 40% of our GDP comes from one customer and one product.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
26 million people in Australia, a lot of smart people, and 40% of our economy is based on one product to one customer. Very bad, right? Can you get that as a business? There's not enough diversification.
In a business like that, you'd be sweating, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but flip it around. Thanks, Chris. Flip it around. And
Thank you so much, mate.
I was going to die then. flip it around, and it's a beautiful platform for us where, you know, we've got half of the lithium in the world.
Yeah.
Right? We've got so many resources that we could be street smart about how we do things, right? And Australia could be a test bed, and not just that, but a forward-looking innovator when it comes to the responsible production and service in our cities for local cities.
Yeah.
Right? Why not? Mm. Why not? We are in the arse end of the world. Let's take that and make it our superpower, not our baggage, right? And that's exactly how I see it, how our country should be looking at it, what we do, right? Yet, unfortunately, we talk about manufacturing in a way that's still stuck in the old dark ages for me. And we should need to be leaning into the fact that there are amazing robotics and automation technology that we can unpack and enable hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of our people in our country to do good, meaningful work that actually serves our own needs and not be driven by export and be driven all these things. How do we serve in our own economy for our own economy?
Yeah.
Right?
So you feel like, I know we've been talking about you know, what's required to like move companies through that transformation, but just sticking for a moment on the topic around that manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
The reason like manufacturing, you know, went offshore in Australia was that it, you know, we couldn't be competitive really. And do you think that new manufacturing approaches change that equation?
So you need to go one level higher. Yeah.
Sure.
Because I've read a lot about this and I know a lot about this side of things, you know. I lean into things and I go deep on the stuff. And the problem we've had with it is that for 20 to 30 years, we as a nation at a national level committed to what we call a comparative strategy, not a competitive strategy, at a government policy level. Are you aware of that?
No.
Comparing to what?
Comparative strategy basically means we become an input in a particular area for others that want to be competitive.
Really? Okay.
Yep. I can share with you all that there's amazing reports that have come out that actually articulate that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That has been the basis of our economy for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Right? We accepted at a government level, at our top line level, that we're going to execute a comparative strategy, not a competitive strategy. Right? Now, for me, that was a major flaw. Mm-hmm. Now, look at it, right? Smart people like us wanting to do great, be competitive, mm-hmm. yet at a top level, at a holding co point of view, let's say, right? Holding co point of view, the strategy is to be a comparative strategy play nation, not a competitive strategy nation, right? It's a difference between what the South Koreans and others have done compared to Australia. If we did what the South Koreans did in terms of competitive strategy, be a different conversation. In addition to that, I'm going to go down this rabbit hole now.
Sure. Here we are.
Is that we actually also went down a neoliberal mindset, which is, you know, down the pathway. I'm not going to get political about things or take parties, but that's the pathway we took. It was a neoliberal marketplace movement, you know, pathway of shifting everything towards globalization, and we're shifting towards a services-based economy. And that's exactly what we've been doing. And that's why financial services are way too powerful in Australia. You got hundreds of thousands of jobs in what I call bullshit jobs, right? Basically supporting finance for the sake of finance, right? Why aren't those
finance
like
is a service, right?
Finance functions to support derivatives of derivatives of derivatives. And amazingly, people are millionaires basically selling fluff, right? Where all those smart people could be doing amazing things and, you know, producing amazing products, services and experience for our country. And they're just in complete shift in where our people operate and live, work and play. Or more like what they do and how they see themselves is one of the big problems in a service-based economy. The UK right now is actually recognizing this big time. And I actually read a great report that came out about a month ago talking about how they create a good jobs economy again. Right?
Okay.
Yeah. Why? We need to do the same here in Australia. right? So if you look back at what we're trying to do now in Australia, which is great, I love what we're trying to do, which is National Reconstruction Fund, which is an extension of, the goodness that the Clean Energy Finance Corporation has done, which is Australia's biggest, green bank, which has done amazingly well, and so forth, bringing returns back to the country many times over. The problem with it is that it's too programmatic, and on top of that, it's only $15 billion. Not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. Mm. I say to people, it's $100 million bets. It's not a lot. So, and that's over a long-term horizon. That's over many, many years. It's not like in two years. We need to do it now, right? So, and it's quite programmatic. It only talks about the fact that we can only do it in 6 or 7 areas. What if I want to? I'll throw it publicly here.
Sure.
We would love to, one of our, what I call our green shots, we call, we take from the past, meaning moonshots, and we've created a 21st century version of those. We call them green shots and blue shots, right? And now one of the green shots that we have is, wouldn't it be amazing if we actually created the world's first circular, most circular, well-designed, closed-loop home appliances brand, right? Mm-hmm. And the current landscape in the Australian market would be, you're not doing robotics, not in defense, it's not health or medical devices, so we're not going to back it. And so in my view is, but we're being circular and sustainable, being sovereign in what we do, why can't we build that here?
Yeah.
Right? In the way that we want to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the reality, is that things are way too programmatic in Australia, which makes it easy for people to basically just tick the boxes, versus enabling a framework for innovation and cross-disciplinary innovation. Talk about innovation. The most successful form of innovation is cross-disciplinary convergent innovation, right? Not process innovation or business model innovation or open innovation. It's when you get multidisciplinary people together to solve complex problems, and that's where true outcomes get achieved, right? So we need to enable cross-disciplinary innovation and deliver a framework that enables us to unblock a lot of things, and enable any form of company and type to be flourished to create good, meaningful jobs in Australia.
Mm. If you imagine the combination of, retail, electronics, automation, and how that plays out in, the future scape, which you describe of these little
micro assembly service centers, the masks, we call them masks,
which is essentially attached to the back end of a physical retail joint. And then,
can you visualize that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you imagine 20 years from now is probably what it's probably going to take at least to get to that point.
Yeah.
But the automation and the robotics behind that would actually be pretty impressive in itself.
Yeah.
But, still needing people on the ground and enabling jobs to kind of manage all of that as well.
Totally.
Rather than what we have now in terms of online or commerce, where you go onto Amazon and it comes from,
Oh, my God, Amazon.
That's the kind of competition. That's what people are used to. That's the way that e-commerce is kind of gone, and it's going to be hard to veer away from that.
100%. Yeah, 100% agree with you. And then it's actually it's exactly why we want to start small. We want to sort of build the believers, both consumers, families, individuals, and companies that come on along the journey. Everything doesn't start with a big bang.
Yeah,
and there's a long term play here that needs to happen.
Yeah,
I haven't shared what our big sort of I won't share it actually.
Yeah. Well, and you know what though, I mean, I believe and I hope to be correct that the way people are generally becoming more aware and more conscious of the things that need to change, and especially younger generations that are coming through, they're being born into this world very aware of the impacts and the situation that they've been born into. And so their priorities are very different to, the kind of more...
Yep. Let's talk about housing affordability right now, right?
Yep.
As a big one, right? It's not off track at all, right?
Yep.
It's not off track at all. It's a great bloody topic, right? Housing affordability we can solve if we reimagine the business model and the ecosystem that needs to surround it, right? It is proven as well that we could actually scale faster in deploying more built world environments if we can actually productize the ecosystem, right? We can bring the amazing things that we know in productization, in software and tech, and bring it to the built world. It's happening right now internationally. It's not just it's not being done in a transformative way for cities right now, right? And what do I mean by that? There are companies already proving through basically, you know, factory building modular homes and delivering them physically to locations. That needs to be scaled. There's two or three great companies in Australia doing right now that right now. One's called Modscape.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if you know Modscape, guys.
I'm familiar with, I don't know them exactly, but I know the kinds of products.
But what we're talking about is we can unblock this housing affordability issue. Yeah. And a lot of it is actually labor. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is sort of inefficiencies in how we get our products. We're still sort of hammering, you know, dip rocks into walls type of stuff.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we know in tech, guys, and modernization of what we do in what we do every day and to come from is that it can be solved.
Yeah.
Right? It's just about, you know, like the government actually put a position in place, which is they want 1.2 million homes, I think it was announced last week, 1.2 million sort of homes to unblock this supply issue.
Yeah.
Okay. What are we doing about it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get unions out of the way.
Yeah.
And let's start doing things that really matter in a technology product-led first approach. And then secondly, how do we basically take a lot of the products and services that go with that and actually deliver them as a service offerings, subscription?
Mm.
Can you imagine that, right? That the brands that are associated in these homes and so forth are not sold as products, but they're delivered as services.
Mm.
And the companies that are associated in this ecosystem, there might be 100 or 200 of them,
mm.
right? All doing their thing, are responsible for each one of those products.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just such a simple thing. Yeah. I see it. I don't know about you. I just see it. I'm like, let's do it.
I mean, it's an amazing vision, but that also, that's quite a mindset shift for the consumer as well, right?
Yep.
100%. It's like, wow, do I own this home? I don't own it. Who owns this home?
Okay, let's unpack that right now. Because at the moment, look at the crazy price that we pay for in Sydney, Melbourne, across Australia, right?
Oh, yeah.
My boys can't buy a house.
No.
Right? No young person can buy a house now. It's actually gut-wrenching, right? It's just wrong. It's just wrong, right? And it can't continue like this. So let's unpack that and say to buy a home in Sydney is $1-3 million now,
yeah.
right? Let's say we buy a brand new home. Let's say it's $1.5-2.5 million now, right?
Yeah.
Build it the old industrialized way,
yeah.
right? You know, and if we productize these experiences, it probably costs a third of that, right? Mm. It probably would cost a third of that, if not half. Right? If we did it in that way, right? Just literally unpack all these things, right? If we turned everything from being labor-oriented to sort of a circular-oriented, productized way, you're taking all of the process and productivity challenges away from the front line where the hammering and carpentry stuff's going on, and you're bringing it back into a productized experience, right? It can be done. It's just about it's about, what does it come back to that I spoke about before? It's about changing what we respect. We respect what's inspected of us, right? So we need to change the incentive structures and the sticks to get there. And so I look at that goal that I read about last week and I thought, I know exactly how we can fix that. It's going to take trillions of dollars to do it, but we need to back ourselves and bloody do it for the sake of our next generations to come. Just one example. It's a built world, right? Homes. Mm. So anyway, I can go on forever about this stuff. But yeah.
Do you have another question? We should.
No, we can move on. That's okay. Yeah. I think that's good. That does unpack that. And I guess, you know.
These are real missions. Right? We went to a mission-driven innovation event when we
Yeah, that's right.
Us, right?
Yeah.
That's a mission. Yeah. We have a mission. It's like 1.2 million homes. Let's make it 2 million homes. That's the mission. That's a mission. 2 million homes by 2035 or 2030, right?
Yeah.
How do we do it?
Well, you know, let's get some people together. I mean, it starts with people taking action.
People and capital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? People, capital, and infrastructure.
Yeah.
The design stuff's the easy stuff and the tech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got all that.
And in terms of that, in terms of the audience and those who actually might be interested in taking action in some form to progress this forwards, what might they do?
Well, that's the tough question, right?
Yeah.
Surround themselves with becoming circular to start with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, believe in the mission, believe in the cause, become purposeful in life.
Mm-hmm.
Recognize that what we're doing is for the next generation to come, like I have. I've accepted that this is what I'm doing for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And that I'm setting the foundations for future generations to sort of take on, right?
Yep.
So I've sort of literally centered around that now, right? Which I'm so proud of and sort of really got clarity around that.
Mm.
Yeah, that's me. I'm visionary. How do we get people to just come along on that journey? So committed to the mission and the principles. And then as we start to bring and formulate teams and activities, we start to basically find pockets of value and clusters of activities. And we need to start clustering things, in my view. That's one of the areas of opportunity, to start clustering thematic geographies, to have certain type of companies that come together to cross-pollinate one another in certain geographies across Australia that do certain things. You may not be aware of this, but in Tokyo, which I love, I spent 2 years there working on and off at Fujitsu, and their Tokyo Realm Network is based on every second or third node is a major node, and each one of those nodes is a thematic region. One of them is the textiles region, the other one is the electronics region. Yeah, so every third node is that in Tokyo. Now, funny enough, in Sydney, we're trying to do that. One of the thought was, how do we do that with the metro at the moment? And we've slowed down that thinking because there's not enough budget and stuff, but we need to lean in and drive it more. We should be able to go to Chatswood and say, Chatswood is the place where we do, I don't know, textiles, blah, blah, blah. And when we rock up to Marrickville or Sydenham, it's the place where we do renewables, right? And that's how you start clustering things to drive cross-industry pollination, cross-disciplinary. Mm. And it's proven in other parts of the world. It's just we're not doing it here. Mm. And for us to do things, we've got to basically take it out to the Aerotropolis, or we need to create these new regions, and maybe we'll reinvent Goulburn or whatever it might be, right? But why not Sydney or Melbourne?
Yeah, and do you see that as... You know, we're talking about like the role of government and these kinds of things and creating those incentives. Do you think that, and you're talking about them being market shapers, do you see that as a part of their role to like encourage those sorts of centres of activity?
Lean in harder
and
work more with capital, because it's not all about government, right, in terms of government is one player, right?
Yeah.
We need to, you know, there's $4 trillion sitting in our sovereign funds, in our super funds. They're not being tapped into. It's all about short-term baby boomer returns.
Yeah.
Right? You know, we're not baby boomers. I don't even know what I'm buying. I'm 52. I don't know what I am. I don't know what I am, actually.
The threshold's up.
I don't know. But
We should probably, I think we're already gone an hour over hour. But that's fine. That's good. I mean, it's been a very enlightening conversation.
I really enjoyed it, guys.
Yeah. Tell us, just before we do wrap up, you've mentioned in the past a movie or a series, and you're also putting a book together. Is there anything you can share about that?
At Circulus, we're building a constellation of organizations. Yeah. One of those nodes in the constellation is, I'm very passionate about narration and storytelling for good. I think there's too much negativity in the world around sustainability and circularity. It's swayed towards, oh shit, we need to get our shit together because 2030 is coming.
What are we going to do?
Right. Yeah. Which actually supports the existing operating model quite a bit still, because we're just going to park it and, you know, let the frog simmer and boarding little, as I say. Yeah,
bit hard.
Versus celebrating us on a common, beautiful, positive mission and pathway to greatness, right? And being entrepreneurial and visionary, and we all sort of similar, I think, because we want to do good.
Yeah.
How do we basically bring amazing stories and capabilities to life to help people actually see the opportunity of the scenarios of the future?
Yeah.
And what I'd love to do next as a major thing is to sort of launch Circulus Studios as a play where we bring together some amazing people to basically drive that narration and for many people. Because, you know, you and I talk about circularity and sustainability and people that I hang out with on the week are like, what the hell are you talking about, right? So we need to unpack that and make it real and simple.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's also sustaining, isn't it? That vision.
It's a positive future, right?
Yeah.
Our younger generation sort of see it that way, right?
And, you know, to your point about, you know, we are manifestations of the stories we tell ourselves.
Totally.
So if we are collectively, you know, saying to ourselves of how bad things are and, oh my God, 2030 is coming, we're screwed.
Yeah, totally.
Then that's going to be our reality.
Totally.
But if we have a more positive approach and celebrate the opportunity of what's possible.
Yeah.
Then that's, you know, kind of that manifests.
Yeah, but it's actually taken one step further and actually demonstrated through the journeys that these amazing practitioners are going on.
That
it's the journey, the struggle, not the corporate videos that are, you know, presenting you know, people having coffees and, you know, writing ESG reports.
Yeah.
Right? It's the struggle of going through to try and unpack and unblock all these things to get to this promised land, right? That's the important thing. So that's sort of one aspect. And then sort of talking about the book. There is a book in me. Like, I, yep. It's a funny thing yep. to say, like, there's a book in me, right? But I just really think that I think there's a way to sort of take our message out there through, you know, ultimately a book. But I'm a big believer in the path that we'll take will actually be the making of the book and the path that we take to bring people together on this journey.
Yeah.
So it'll be sort of a, let's call it an open version of a book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring a lot of people together and celebrate, you know, its achievement, and it becomes a platform to amplify the message even further. Yeah. But yeah, I'm sort of, there's a lot of pockets of goodness out there. You know, a lot of things we want to do. And as I said to you, there's a, you know, we're at stage 1A of a five step master plan, which will take about 75 years to 100 years to execute.
Well, thank you for bringing it to the world. It's a, you know, very inspiring, the work that you've decided to take on. It's a very ambitious and audacious goal with very good intentions and exactly what we need right now as society. And privileged to have you to be sharing that journey with you, and can't wait to see where it goes.
Thank you, guys. It really, yes, Luke. Yeah, I just really want to thank you all. It was the fact that we met just recently again, rekindled the fire a bit. Great. It was great, right?
It's fantastic.
And I knew we were going to have fun on this sort of podcast as well, because you know, leaning into it that way. And I can talk forever, as we know, but it's all coming from goodness. And I want to see you guys do well and continue doing well in what you do as well.
Beautiful, Nick. Thank you, mate. It's just a pleasure for us to have all your energy and vision coming on the show.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, mate.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please feel free to check us out on our website, digitalvillage.network, for our past episodes. We'll be back next month on the last Wednesday of every month, as we are, with more great stories and guests. See you then.